Joe, how you doing?
I'm just fine, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing very well, thanks. Well, tonight we wanted to talk about national security as a scam, a cover for the oligarchy's agenda, perpetual debt, corporate welfare, of course, global plunder, and of course, mind control and social engineering. It has nothing to do with really protecting us or protecting our freedoms, as the government's supposed to do. It's all about mind control. It's all about, you know, plundering wealth from the taxpayer, from the world. So national security. When I think of national security, I think of two quotes. One's very short. Samuel Johnson: patriotism is the last refuge of a scoundrel. Of course, another one is by Smedley Butler, and this kind of sums up, at least I think, the one level of understanding national security as a scam. I think there's a more esoteric level to it. But as his famous quote from War is a Racket: I spent 33 years and 4 months in active military service, and during that period, I spent most of my time as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer, a gangster for capitalism. I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for National Citibank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in raping half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1902-1912. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for the American sugar interest in 1916. I helped make Honduras ripe for American fruit companies in 1903. In China in 1927, helped see to it that Standard Oil went on its way unmolested. Looking back on it, I might have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was to operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. Smedley Butler. So, national security. What do you have to say about that?
Well, that's a great quote by Smedley. And it would be nice to have the quote given with the family ownership of those corporations he mentioned. Mm-hmm. Because you'd get, the Rothschilds, the Rockefellers, the Bush family. I mean, they're the ones who own those corporations. And so you can see that the military was just an extension of the oligarchs. You know, there was this kind of intern step of rigged elections and a facade of a democratic government, but ultimately control of the army was always in the hands of the oligarchs, and it was always for the purpose of, you know, enriching them. Now, one of the problems, of course, you know, that the oligarchs faced in their process of world domination is that citizens would find out what was going on. I mean, the quote by Smedley is a perfect example. So they started to focus on keeping track of us, and also on very sophisticated way to control our behavior and our minds. Right? And so the NSA came about, the National Security Agency. Long history, I'm sure you're aware of it. I think some people probably aren't. It started out as a cryptologic, agency. It would bust codes. But pretty quickly got under the control of a military. It went into the business of spying on citizens.
Mm-hmm. Joe, can I give you a call back? I'm getting a really
of
bad
course, call. Of
so
course, sure.
Might as well call catch right it back. Early.
Okay. Yeah, let's call back. No problem.
Okay, we're recording again. Sorry about that. Okay.
Okay, no problem. Anyway, so, I don't want to give like a long history of it, but I think it's worthwhile for people to know that, that basically from certainly the end of World War II to today, the security agency, the NSA, and the CIA, and the people who operate American observation have been basically outside of the control of democracy. A real good example of that was when the NSA was caught wiretapping Frank Church, you know, the Church Commission, the guy who was like trying to expose MKUltra, and they were illegally intercepting all of his communications. In fact, they've always been basically unconstitutional. And then, you know, when you get to the situation today because of the war on terror, so-called, you have a situation where Congress can't really investigate what the NSA is doing. And this is really the, kind of the point where democracy just ends, because it was after, you know, 9/11, and Bush created an order that basically says, you know, we're trying to prevent terrorism, but it put it outside. It put the NSA activity outside of review, really, by Congress. And so there's been some complaints, you know, by people in Congress that, you know, that this whole thing is unconstitutional, but no one has really been able to stand up to it. You know, they say, well, the Patriot Act gave us these powers. You know, remember the Patriot Act. So somehow the Patriot Act basically brought the Fourth Amendment to an end. And I, you know, you had read the quotes, and I think they were very important people to know. I wanted to read the Fourth Amendment because a lot of people don't even know that this is something that is supposed to protect them. But, you know, it's part of the original Bill of Rights, and it just states that the right of the people to secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, mm-hmm. supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. A lot of people don't realize just how powerful and descriptive the Fourth Amendment is, right? I mean, it talks about a process whereby you have to have someone swear against the person who is going to be searched or seized, mm-hmm. and that you have to actually describe what you're going to search and the persons that, you know, you're going to do this to. Now, think about metadata, where 100% of the individuals are searched, right? Mm-hmm. We're all searched. This communication you and I are having is being searched. Now, I'm sorry, but there is no way that the grammar of the Fourth Amendment can be seen as not being violated by a process whereby 100% of our communication, every damn one of them, is being searched without any process at all that we are aware of, right? So this would be, you know, my thought about our current situation, and we'll go into the details of this, I'm sure. But Tim, I just think that it's completely unconstitutional. The people who hear us talking and kind of agree with our position, I would hope that, you know, get a hold of a local level politician and complain and say, look, I don't care if it's a congressperson, an alderman, if it's a local dog catcher, just someone that you know who has some political post, contact them and say, you know what, so you're going to do your damn job. I want you to get in to exposing the surveillance of the people underneath your auspice, mm-hmm. you're the people who have elected you, whose Fourth Amendment's right are being violated every day, every minute, every hour by the surveillance technique of the NSA.
Yeah, and there's no enforcement. As you say, the Fourth Amendment is very clear, and specific laws have been passed, particularly the the FISA law back in 1978, actually had criminal punishment. For each violation. And of course, as about a little more than 10 years ago, about 2005, the New York Times, after the election, of course, 2004 election, ran a story about these abuses at the NSA and how George Bush had ordered this massive surveillance in direct violation of the FISA law, and there is no enforcement. There's no indictment or there's no conviction or indictment. In fact, Congress retroactively legalized it, which is illegal, and it also protected the telecoms, which were involved in it too, from any lawsuits. Although that was a violation of their contracts with their customers, but they passed special legislation to protect them from any litigation that might ensue from the revelations of this massive surveillance. But the whole telecom industry, the whole tech industry, is largely implicated in the scandal, because that's what it's all about. That's what the internet was created for, massive surveillance, out of Silicon Valley and these things. So, the rot is deep, and the reason why there's no conviction, enforcing the law, is because the political authorities are not accountable to the people. They are accountable to the oligarchs who set this whole thing up.
Yeah, the secret society has created basically a majority in both the Congress and the Senate. Obviously, they own the White House. They're in control of, I'm sure, all of the high level of the military. And then, of course, these agencies, the FBI and the NSA, are just lapdogs. So the citizen is in a very impotent position. One thing that we can try, because what we really need to do is to find ways to sound the alarm, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're not going to be able to somehow convince a major newspaper or, someone has some kind of capacity to communicate on a vast scale that they need to do this. I mean, I think that would just be about a death sentence at this point.
Yeah.
But what we might be able to do is to basically get more and more of the public aware of this. And I think it's this kind of happening. And I think that's one of the things that is kind of falling out of the new media, the stuff that you and I are engaging in right now as we talk, that the new media has sort of part and parcel in it an expose of the surveillance state. It's just everywhere, almost, in every single kind of alternative information source I listen to. It's just sort of something that's understood and often implied. And so that is a great illumination, and it just needs to become 100 times, 1,000 times, 100,000 times greater, so that every single person knows that it is an unconstitutional coup that has occurred against their constitutional protections. Another thing, so that's one thing, is just information, input to the population. The second thing I'd like to see is lawsuits. You can't get at, the NSA. I mean, these things would just be impossible. But you might be able to get a lawsuit that at least could get some publicity against these cesspool corporations that are permitting encryption to be built into their devices that the NSA has access to.
Yeah, the backdoor stuff. Yeah,
the backdoor stuff. I mean, that stuff is clearly in violation of the Fourth Amendment. And I also think it violates a lot of production disclosure regulations that might be the basis for lawsuits. You'd need to have a more clever attorneys than me to get that set up. But I think that you might be able, particularly if you found the right judge, to create a conviction. And then, of course, it'd be overturned by higher courts. But nevertheless, you'd create an enormous publicity moment. Mm-hmm. Be able to expose it really well. You could say, look, here's how it works. This is what they've done. And remember, the other thing is the cesspool, internet companies that like search engines like Google.
Yeah.
I mean, Google should be basically just put out of existence immediately because of its acquiescence and cooperation with illegal to the Fourth Amendment, giving data to the government without any kind of process. The idea that our communication is somehow a commercial product because we use their service to communicate that like somehow our constitutional rights end where, you know, Google's electronic process begins. You know, I'm sorry. I'm very sorry, Tim, but I don't believe that. I don't think that that's a coherent argument. I would like to see Google defend that to a jury of my damn peers. I'd love to get their little attorney up there and explain how I just am evaporated once I start my process of communication to Tim Kelly.
Yeah, well, it's that.
I want to hear their arguments when they explain to a jury of my peers, of other human beings, right? Yeah. They might be able to get some drones to agree with their position, but I don't think they can get humans to agree with their position.
Yeah, they'll say, read the terms and conditions, right?
read the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah, read the Fourth Amendment, yeah. And they just sell all that data to whatever alphabet soup agency asks for it, or whatever corporate marketing company is asking for it.
This should be no different than a wiretapping of phones, which you'll recall for over a century was handled through basically grand juries and a process by which wiretaps could be, you had to justify doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, given that, now just Tim, here we go. Okay, how many terrorists have they brought to heel with this process?
Actual?
Yeah, I'll tell you the truth. I can't think of a damn one, right?
Well, they can't admit that to you because that's classified.
Well, okay, but I'm sorry, but I mean, I don't admit to, you know, the Santa Claus until somebody brings him forward. So the thing is,
our successes are secret, right?
I mean, the terrorists aren't getting, you know, like. Stacked up like cordwood in front of the penal colonies. So I would just have to say that all I can see is zero. So the idea that, well, you know, the current terrorist situation is so critical and the internet is so different that we're just going to forget about all of the legal process that in terms of electronic communication had been established for over 100 years. We're just going to throw that out. And then at the meantime, right, they will create every imaginable use for law enforcement, government enforcement. They use this stuff basically now. You're going to see it come out that they're going to be using it for what's called precog, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they can already see there's already commercials about this. They had one of the commercials for IBM Watson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it ran here in California for a while. And it had this guy, you know, these criminal guys going to a 7-Eleven. And unfortunately, out in front of the 7-Eleven was a cop, right? So it looked like, well, hey, the cop was there and the crime was thwarted. And then the advertisement came on and it said, you know, Watson and IBM are, you know, we can now see into the future, basically, where there's going to be a bad moment. And so, you know, they can be more effective policing. Now, in the very, very most general sense, okay, you put more cops where there's going to be more crime.
Yeah.
The problem is, where does that stop?
Yeah.
You know, when there's no oversight, they can, you know, they're going to be ending up on your doorstep gang. You know, you're under arrest because the demographics suggest you're about to, you know, do something treasonous.
Yeah. 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 Our algorithm shows us you're committing a crime tomorrow.
Wrong websites and here's the probability and you're already convicted. I mean, so this is the thing. Look, that's an absurd example, but the citizen, we have to fight back now. Right now is when we have to start fighting back. We can't wait until the technology descends on top of us because they will have the ability to restrain us. Right. So we need to fight now immediately. We need to resist the technical slavery that's descending.
Mm-hmm. But throughout history, we've heard the cry of national security, defending the country. And this is all done in the name of protecting us. But just if you examine history and you take a very skeptical view of some of these events or wars, you'll find just beneath the surface that what's not being protected are the liberties and properties and lives of American people, but the pursuit of the interest of Wall Street, the big banks, high finance. I mean, every war, I mean, show me a war America's fought that's genuinely been defensive. I you know, I think after, you know, I think after the
what,
after
the, since, since the Alamo, I mean, yeah, zero.
I'm thinking, you know, I don't know how you want to categorize the so-called American Civil War. If you want to call the Confederacy America, I think
Civil
it was,
War is a Freemason population reduction process. It wasn't even a war.
But I remember it was at the Beverly Hillbillies. It was the grandma said this, and she someone brought up the Civil War. She goes, "The Civil War? That's when the Yankees invaded America." So, but it's the same thing there. It's oligarchs, planning bloodshed and plunder. Come on, that's low hanging fruit. The Spanish American War. Okay, yeah, right.
Yeah, that was a great national risk. You know, I mean, the whole thing is preposterous. Look, there's no one that's going to invade us. There are no national security interests. 9/11 was completely fake. We haven't really been subjected to any kind of terrorism in an organized sense. Oh, gee whiz, since the Revolutionary War. I mean, there's just nothing out there.
Yeah,
it's always been about incremental control of the population.
The close with the 60s and those groups were all assets. Those groups were all concocted by by Operation Chaos and COINTELPRO and
the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yeah,
I mean, look at that. Look at. I mean, there's like, and this is one that's pretty well vetted. It's
Donald DeFries
more or less out in the open, and people can look at this. I mean, this was the greatest terrorist event in the history of America. It was, we talked about this. This was a huge television show. Everyone was sitting there. They were lobbing in grenades into this building. The whole thing was on fire. No one knew if Patty was in the building. I mean, she had for some reason become a member of this and was robbing banks. I mean, it was just a sitcom from outer space. Then suddenly, because of this, right, the police around America need to develop the SWAT teams.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Okay, so there they are. You've had the SLA kidnapping poor Patty and robbing banks and then having an Alamo-type shootout in downtown L.A., but no problem. We'll respond to this with the development of SWAT teams, where the old-time police guy who would walk down the street, and steal an apple and was like someone everybody knew and there was like peace in the world. That's replaced by this guy, by a whole army of guys with gigantic fascist outfits on, right? These huge bulletproof vests and helmets and automatic weapons. And they come out of, I mean, it's just like basically a nightmare of German fascism fantasy, right? This is just insane. But then you go, well, wait a second, where'd the SLA come from? And you go, oh my gosh, all of these guys were in these mind control experiments in Vacaville prison where MKUltra was. What the heck? It almost looks like it was all set up, like all the world is a stage. Doesn't it look that way to you, Tim?
Yeah, and all that chaos that was sown in the late 60s and 70s was all created, by the foundations, by these intelligence agencies, by the media. It's all, Billy Ayers, look at him, guilty as hell, free as a bird, as he said, as the government dropped its case against him, because supposedly they violated, the Fourth Amendment or something in prosecuting him. Oh, yeah, right. Then he's set. He's allowed to go free. Then he's becomes a very has a very lucrative career. He's an advisor with Barack Obama. Writes
sure.
books for him.
Where's our protection against terrorism?
Yeah.
The whole thing is completely ridiculous. I mean, we probably shouldn't be dismissive in our discussion because I'm sure there are people who are listening to this who don't have our background information. But it is just something that I'll just assert as a fact, and people who are curious about this, if they want background and information, or if we don't do enough of it, mm-hmm. I'm sure you can contact either Tim or myself on our emails and we'll be happy to help people, get a grip as to this complete artificial process by which the government justifies the increase in the surveillance state. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, look. After 9/11, I went to my airport. I live in Santa Barbara. We have an airport that has one terminal, right, at this time. One terminal. I mean, it had, like United and one other airline. Okay, so we've got, you know, Santa Barbara. We've got all these, fruit stands. And, I mean, we were the first kind of, same-sex bathroom place in the world, right? Yes, yeah. And so after 9/11, you come up, and they've got three guys with automatic weapons. Army outfits.
Now, what is that going to do?
Yeah, and that's like...
You, if you had a mad bomber, they can shoot bullets at the explosion? I mean,
it's just obvious a way for the government to put, a kind of intimidating, presence in front of the citizen. Yeah. And then you go inside, I'm there in my little bag, and they've got the guy goes, you have to take your shoes off, and you've got to go through these scanners. I mean, what the heck is, it's like, well... Don't you have some simple method of determining if I've got a bomb on me or something? How come you got to do all this crap? But it's just mind control. That's what this stuff is. Well,
think about aviation in general, because psychologically, you're in a plane if you're vulnerable because you're in a plane. But really, if terrorists really want to go out and wreak havoc, they could go out and rush hour traffic, and almost kill as many, many people.
If they want to kill a bunch of people, they can just go to the lines of people waiting to get through the security, blow a bomb up there. I mean, they're totally vulnerable.
Yeah,
all the security guys are on the other side. There's hundreds of us all piled in. And I'll tell you the truth, a lot of people have been waiting so long, they would actually welcome the bomb blowing up. So, I mean, the idea that this is somehow creating security is simply preposterous. It's not a real idea, folks. It's like a... like the peasants rooting for the Green Bay Packers. I mean, these aren't Packers. They're professional people from someplace else. The idea that these long lines and where they, this is just, they're just, indoctrinating people to a lower level of citizenry where, there's going to be more groping and basically it's just training you to not have constitutional rights.
Yeah, but Joe, there hasn't been another 9/11 since 9/11 because we're being groped all the time. That's what I had someone tell me one time. So
no, well that's a very rational argument, except the fact that there wasn't a 9/11, even a 9/11.
How do you remember 9/11 when you don't know what happened to begin with?
Exactly. I mean, every time I see the video of the plane disappearing into the building, and I go, wait a second. I'm not like a big physicist. I've had some physics, though. Have to admit, I've had a few classes. I do know about the second law, right? I know that for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Mm-hmm. So I know if a plane is coming at 500 miles an hour and hits a steel building, it's exactly the same. It's not any difference than if the building was going 500 miles an hour and hit the plane.
But right?
It's the same thing.
Everything changed after 9/11.
Well, I guess it did. I guess all the laws of physics.
Even the laws of physics.
Because happened, the plane just should have been knocked backwards and just on its ass and parts fly all over the place. Instead, a plane with aluminum wings flies through and disappears into a building with steel frame pillars, right? Right. So
if you're telling me I can't trust television, Joe, I don't know what I'm going to do.
You can trust it to be a house of illusion.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what you can trust. So we're really pretty far down into the technical enslavement of the citizens because they've got the media now not just under control but willing to put up with and produce these cartoons and tell the public that it's real. No one blows the whistle. So that means they've got, a lockdown on all of the administrative heads of these organizations and a lot of the actual technical people, right? They've got to have a total lockdown on all that. And it goes to the fact that when CBS came out, you knew something was evil was coming because it had the all-seeing eye as its logo.
Yes.
It's this should have been your first clue. And then if you look at the NSA, what's its logo? Once again, you got the all-seeing damn eye, just like you do in the dollar bill. So, you know, there is a secret society that is laughing at us, the slaves, the manipulated, the mindless, right? That's why we were called deadheads, right? When mm-hmm. the great dead got out, deadheads. And so the alternative media has a responsibility to wake people the hell up, right? That's what we're here to do, because when you look at the NSA, it's obviously just, and all of the other, you know, alphabet technical yeah. surveillance stuff, it's just here to enslave us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's enslave us, whether it's direct slavery or through debt bondage, because all these wars, of course, are very expensive, yeah. and they run up the national debt, which benefits the central banks, which are owned by a handful of secretive families. You know, the Rothschilds, probably the world, you know, House of, you know, the Dutch family, the
the Warburgs,
the Windsors, these things, you know, the
You know, that's a very timely thing, Tim, because you know, we're as we sit here talking so amiably, World War III may be about to break out with you know, the insane dyed hair guy Trump. About to go mano a mano with Kim Jong-un, the purportedly crazy Korean dictator. I don't know if you caught it, but a few hours ago, North Korea went on some kind of like civil alert. This is basically the status that occurs when they think an attack is about mm-hmm. to occur. Now, you know, when you're dealing with this kind of insanity, who knows what's real? But when we're talking about how they've used war as and terrorism, right, as the basis to ratchet the technological enslavement state to mm-hmm. a higher level, you have to wonder if this isn't going to be another one of those episodes, because they've already planted the seeds. You know, they talked about Korea having the capacity to create suitcase nukes, and one of the scenarios for, you know, the final fascist you know, night falling on America would be, you know, a suitcase nuke gets in, you kill a couple hundred thousand people in the city, and blame it on Kim Jong-un, and then you would then say, well, we've got to, you know, have like the checkpoints at every single block, you know, and mm-hmm. So anyway, that's why it's very timely. Yeah, we were before the, you know, we started, we were talking about how timely the topic seemed to be. It's because it's a crazy world and we're trying to disclose it. But it is interesting, isn't it, that, you know, you have to wonder, just is Korea going to be used as like in the theater of the absurd and trying to ratchet it up? Because the guy does seem kind of artificial. I mean, you know, Kim, he just seems so crazy that he's just kind of a perfect foil for the, you know, this, you know, and now if you do have a suitcase nuke go off in the US, I would really smell a rat. I talked to a friend of mine who knows a little bit about nuclear bomb constructions, and believe me, he's not building one. Okay, I'll just get put that right there. He just happens to know, he's a physicist, and he says that actually they couldn't do it. Now, what he said was this about the suitcase bombs. He says that you need a lot of testing in order to build one, because, you know, for a Hiroshima type bomb, he says basically it's pretty simple. You just got to push all of the U-235 or plutonium, whatever you're going to use, you got to get maybe 20 pounds of it, push it together real quick, and then it'll blow up. You get a big explosion, nuclear bomb. But for these smaller units, the suitcase bombs, it's much more precise, and you need a lot of testing, right? Mm-hmm. You've got to test, because you're talking about you have to have a lot of stuff go on like in a thousandth of a second, right? You know, certain chemical reactions have to occur to, you know, exactly these precise kind of things, because it's much more complex. So he says that you got to experiment a whole bunch to make sure you get the right formula for a suitcase bomb. And that would be something that, you know, you would know about if Korean were doing those kinds of experiments. He says that would be something you could pick up very, very easily. And so he says, nah, they don't have, unless someone's given them one. Now, having said that, I wouldn't put it past another idea we had before we were talking, is that, you know, who is really in back of Kim Jong-un? You know, you might have the CIA or some, you know, agency that is ambitious to create a more, you know, expansion technological, you know, enslavement state. So, I don't know, what do you think?
The Korean Peninsula was sort of the staging ground for the Cold War, because when you had the invasion in 1950, in June 1950, apparently the U.S. National Security State was taken unawares by it, was shocked by it, because that probably isn't true. I think it was Admiral Hillenkoetter, the first director of the Central Intelligence Agency, said that they were fully aware of troops massing, and there have been a bunch of cross-border disputes. The whole Korea Peninsula was divided to create a conflict after World War II. Arms from Japan were shipped into Korea in 1945, 46. Some were shipped into Vietnam to help Ho Chi Minh, and this was stoking the flames of a conflict. And these two areas are going to be the undeclared wars of the Cold War. And of course, what it did was it legitimized UN operations, because it was a UN operation. Truman unilaterally decided to intervene in that conflict without a request from Congress to declare war, so it was illegal there. But it was sort of a collective action, or some sort of collective security act. So one step closer to the New World Order.
Absolutely. Great point. Great point. That's when one of the key moments is when Truman circumvented the the constitutional requirement for Congress to declare war.
And even FDR, though he provoked and knew about Pearl Harbor, still had to go to Congress and ask for a declaration of war. So did Woodrow Wilson in 1917. So that was one, you know, huge step towards that. Another thing is, of course, there's, you know, we had 1954. Dean Acheson wrote in his memoirs that Korea saved us. What did he mean by that? Well, what he meant was this was a crisis, because at the time there was a lot of there was real resistance in Capitol Hill, particularly among the Republicans, for the Truman Doctrine, for the Cold War. It was particularly a Democratic program at the time. It wasn't a Republican thing. And you had people like Robert Taft up there, some real like old right, non-interventionist Republicans who were very skeptical, Midwestern types, these types that were. That filled the ranks of the American First Committee, you know, prior to America's entry into the First World War. So they're very skeptical about this new crusade that we're supposed to be fighting against our erstwhile allies, the Soviet Union. But Korea stopped all that. Then the money spigots opened up, for the Cold War. NATO got funded. NATO became permanent. I mean, NATO was supposed to be temporary. These things, of course, it never was, because NATO was planned before the end of World War II. So all these things, this is an unfolding plan. So all these threats and security threats, and I think it was the National Security Memorandum 68, which was written in 1950, and it stated, as a pretext for Washington's imperial policy, they needed an enemy, and it said even if the Soviet Union didn't exist, this policy would have been followed anyway. And it also called for like this sort of military Keynesianism, where military spending was necessary to maintain economic growth, which is a flawed economic, concept, because it's no free lunch. I mean, what you're spending on aircraft carriers, or you aren't spending on schools, or houses, or food, whatever. I mean, it's like, But then again, in the Bretton Woods system, the World War II system, where the dollar became enthroned as a world reserve currency, you could more or less just create perpetual debt to pay for these things. So it was a gift that they kept on giving. So war became an economic planning, a societal planning thing, a huge social engineering scheme. We talked about the sort of the destruction of the ethnic neighborhoods. War, that was a big part of war planning, because these ethnics weren't considered loyal. Their loyalty was suspect. The construction of the interstate highway system was originally, the pretext was military planning, because Eisenhower had been to Germany and had been impressed by the Autobahn. And also he had trouble during the First World War getting from one end of the country to the other. So this is all part of military planning. Although if you look at it, it wasn't set up to transfer military hardware. It was set to dispersal of the population, social engineering. But the big thing, if you look at, if you recall the 1967, the report from Iron Mountain, which some people write off as a spoof or some, as a joke, but it really, if you read it, what they're talking about is mirrored in NSC 68, the necessity for a constant enemy, for social cohesion, for military planning. What Report from Iron Mountain said was how would we deal with societal stability if we had a peace breakout?
That's actually kind of like almost platonic at this point.
Yes.
What they were talking about. I mean, my God, who could even imagine what the U.S. would be like in the peacetime? I mean, how long have we actually been at war for? There was a few months here and there, but basically since the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Yeah. We've been fighting somewhere, and believe me, it'll never stop.
Well, no, because do you remember? If I had the quote here, Norman Dodd.
Yeah.
And what he revealed, he gave an interview to Jared Griffith back in the early 80s. And he was the head investigator for the Reese Committee. And they were investigating the involvement or the un-American, so-called un-American activities of the tax-free foundations. And he sent up an investigator, Catherine Casey, to read to the minutes. What happened was, for some reason or other, people who were running the Carnegie Foundation invited him up to look at their minutes. He ripped it off as people who were just inexperienced. They hadn't read through the minutes themselves. They thought nothing damaging was in there. But what he found was, I have it here. He says, this is what he said. The experience you just referred to came about in response to a letter that I had written to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, asking certain questions and gathering certain information. On the arrival of that letter, Dr. Johnson, who was then the president of the Carnegie Endowment, telephoned me and said, come to New York, and next time I was up there, come out and stop him by, we'll show you. And what happened was he ended up sending this lady, Catherine Casey, who's a lawyer investigator, to go read through the minutes. And what she found was, in 1908, which was the year that Carnegie Foundation began operations. In that year, the trustees, there was a meeting for the minutes show. The meetings for the meeting among the trustees in the minutes, or a specific question was raised, in which they discussed throughout the balance of that year. The question is there any means known more effective than war in assuming you wish to alter the life of the entire people? And they conclude that no more effective means than war to that end is known to humanity. So then in 1909, they raised a second question and discussed it, namely, how do we involve the United States in war? And then, of course, you should have the 1914, World War I breaks out. In 1917, we're at war. And then in the minutes, it says then time passes and we are eventually in war. This is 1917, which would be World War One. And this is what the minutes read. At the time, they recorded on their minutes a shocking report in which they dispatched to President Wilson a telegram cautioning him to see that the war does not end too quickly. Finally, of course, the war is over. And the time interest shift over, preventing what they call a reversion to life in the United States to what it was prior to 1914, peacetime. When World War I broke out, at that point, they come to the conclusion that to prevent a reversion, we must control education in the United States. And this is when they make an effort to buy out the American Historical Association, to buy out historians. And many of them reject the plan to start. They want to say bribe historians to start portraying American history in a certain way to their students, and they wouldn't do it. So what they did was they worked out like a $400,000 grant to the American Historical Association, bought it out, and they created a stable of reliable court historians to fundamentally change the education of the American people regarding their history so they could have perpetual war. And this is in the minutes of the meeting.
Yeah, that. Thanks for bringing that out. I've heard about that. I've never actually got the details. Amazing.
And it was Charles and Mary Byrd, these famous historians, who rejected it outright. But they said, well, then we don't need you. We'll just throw a bunch of money at some college student, some master's student, some students who are getting their master's degree and PhDs, and bribe them and, give them an endowment, give them a job, and they'll just do the bidding of the oligarchs. And it worked. And the idea was they would use a Rockefeller Foundation to fund domestic education, a Carnegie Endowment for International Peace to control international education. More or less perception management, mind control. And this is the early part of the 20th century. Of course, then we get the 20th century with all its wars and crises, all the trauma.
Yeah, and I think that that's about as important of information as the public can possibly have, mm-hmm. is that the wars are by design. You know, the idea that this is history unfolding is ridiculous and untrue. It's simply untrue. What you're seeing is population reduction, mm-hmm. And money being made, and also enslavement technology being created. You know, look at the ultimate terror weapon, the nuclear bomb. Mm-hmm. It was decided at the Bohemian Grove to develop the thing. And at the meeting, there was nothing but Bohemian Grove members and high-level Freemasons, mm-hmm. right? Like Oppenheimer, you know. So that was how this thing got developed. The public then was eventually told, well, we had to do it because we were afraid the Germans would have it. Right. And then the technology got out within a few months. And then the next thing you know, the Russians had it. And American school children are learning to duck and cover, mm-hmm. right, instead of reading about the Fourth Amendment. Mm-hmm. So you can see how war is a racket. War is for the purposes, the three purposes, you know, which are to reduce the populations of the groups they don't like, to make money, and to develop the technology that they're going to use for this permanent slave state. So when you look at World War One, in light of the information you just gave us, I think you have a pretty clear platform to understand what happened. And when the historians give you a blank face when you ask them why did World War One exist, why it brought it about, you know what? From now on, you can just the people can just recite what you said.
Yeah,
this was how World War One came into existence.
Mm-hmm. And it involves well thought out, high level malevolence. You know, it's not an accident of history. And you know, in the '20s and early '30s, you did have this return to normalcy. And you had this lot of bitterness about World War I, because the public was generally aware that they had been more or less conned into that war. And you had the thing like the Dies Committee and investigating the Merchants of Death, these things, and a lot of books were written. And that fact, Smedley Butler wrote his book, War's a Racket in the Interwar Period.
Yeah, I just think that, you know, you have to go a little bit further to get the best kind of understanding, the kind of understanding that will help someone to take action. And one of the key things is the lifetime actor. Mm-hmm. You know, you get guys like Allen Ginsberg or, you know, Gordon Wasson, Gregory Bateson, and it's all peace and love up front. And then you're looking back and you see, you know, there's malevolence, right? They're just really evil. And so you have to think about when you get historical figures that create hate. You know, I've mentioned that Trump and Hillary Clinton were selected because they created the maximum amount of hatred in the people who were opposed to them.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's why they were selected. So then you have this passionate dialectic that is mistaken as real democracy, right?
Yes,
because people want so badly their particular, you know, we've got to defeat Hillary. We can't let the pussy-grabbing Donald, you know, take the White House, you know, so that the hatred of the puppet is what substitutes for real democracy. So extrapolating from that, you look backwards to, say, Hitler.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go, well, gee, you know, it's very suspicious. He is so perfectly constructed to hate, and then he wants to fight down to the very last guy, right, for some reason. You know, he says, like, the whole nation has to die if it fails to, you know, achieve my goals. And then he disappears. We don't see him anymore somehow at the end of the war. You know, sure could be one of these really clever lifetime actors, in my opinion, right? Be, you know, it's a little complicated, but at the same time, you look at the crucifix, which is a well-known Masonic symbol, representing the broken cross, mm-hmm. of destroyed Christianity. And then you look at the fact that they set the German legions up as kind of cutouts of Roman legions, mm-hmm. right? So somebody had a hatred of Rome for some reason they wanted to reap vengeance on. Sure is suspicious. Sure seems like a little bit of research might want to get done in this area. Maybe get free of the mind control for a little bit and actually looking at, well, what brings this stuff about. And, you know, it's a good time, very timely to attend, because we have this new guy, Kim Jong-un, the crazed Korean brother slaughtering, just evil individual with the suitcase nukes. And, you know, I don't know. I'll tell you the truth. I think in a month this all will blow over, because I don't, you know, I mean, there's no...
Yeah, the saber rattling serves a function.
It serves a function. I think that may just be enough. But if there is a suitcase, you know, nuke event in the U.S., then I would say, you know, we ought to put some sunlight on the Kim Jong-un, because the fact is he could well be just an artificial creation, a lifetime actor kind of character, you know, just set up for the purpose of, you know, being crazy and someone that, justifies our military response.
Yeah, it justifies 28,000 troops being there. And that's huge. That's a huge boondoggle there, and military hardware and, you know, updated, missile systems and having the Navy out there. Of course, that also puts our Navy close to China. There's a pretext for maybe challenging China's claims in the South. You know, I always love the headline, this is U.S. Navy challenges China's claim in South China Sea. I'm like, what don't you get about the name of that sea? Well, China Sea, right? We have to patrol the oceans and make sure the sea lanes are open. Our job is to, is to go around dictating to the world, the borders, make sure they're maintaining peace everywhere. The Navy, it's a global force for good. As the
absolutely, and at the pre-show for the Super Bowl, when you get to see the flag brought out that covers the entire stadium, it just makes you feel good to be an American.
Yeah, an aircraft carrier so big, it's an amazing piece of technology, I guess, in engineering, I suppose, but it's also one big giant target for a silkworm missile. So it's completely useless against a power that has the ability to shoot back, like a China. But you spend a lot of money. And let's not, just talk about national security in general. It's a scam, it's a financial scam. The trillions of dollars that have gone unaccounted for at the Pentagon. Remember 9/11? Remember 9/10? 9/10, Donald Rumsfeld talking about $2.1 trillion missing. I think the number's up to close to $9 trillion now that they can't account for. So there's a lot of overcharging, a lot of embezzling going on to things that many people speculated about, secret space program, or just money being siphoned off, into supposing the weapons programs. The F-35 fighter that can't fly in rain, it's not just incompetence, that's embezzlement. That's people enriching themselves.
It's just a cesspool. I mean, basically, the Pentagon is just a conduit of wealth to the the secret society.
Yeah.
Well, I'll bet you if you actually got in there and did a real audit that you wouldn't find $1.10 was spent even on the stupid and insane idea that they have, for like national security. But I bet you if you trace it, it would just go straight. I mean, they don't, you won't even get a widget or some kind of, like gun that can shoot around a corner or something. Or you're just going to get nothing. just paperwork that disappears, and people like the Bush family and the Rothschilds, they just take it all.
It's never been audited. The place has never been audited. Think about that. The opportunity there for embezzlement. It's like, remember what they found at HUD back in the 80s? Then it was like $50 billion. It's nothing compared to what's going on at the Pentagon, but it's like a criminal, being run like a criminal enterprise, and that's what's happening because there's no accountability. There's no oversight if you can't. The money's going somewhere. It's not disappearing. Don't worry.
Right.
No one ever loses money. Money always finds a home. It's never an orphan, right?
You see, I think that really, and that's one of the reasons why I am a little worried about the situation with Korea, is that I think we're getting close to the end of the dollar.
Yes.
They're the stealing is just at such a gigantic level at this point. I mean, the national debt you know, is $25 trillion just on what you can see, but then you've got, you know, like Social Security and Medicare, which are just completely insane. You know, you're up to hundreds and hundreds of trillions of dollars. Obviously, the relationship between our economy and the debt is no longer possible to bridge. And so at some point, the currency is going to collapse. And in the meantime, though, while people are taking it seriously, while it's basically still working as a store of wealth, the people who know it's going to explode and go to zero, they're just getting every single thing they can.
Yeah, real wealth. I think
all of everything that they think will have value after the reset, all the land, all the building, the gold, the silver, whatever, they're just stealing money. Know that they know, you know, that they are the people who would do the audit if there was ever going to be one. So they're just, that's why when you read about these trillions of dollars that are getting swapped, and this is why, you know, I'm pretty sure that, you know, how it'll collapse will just be in a few hours, because there are so many trillions of dollars that are out there, you know, in electronic accounts that basically have the power of the dollar, but are so gigantic. I mean, there has to be some kind of system of restraint. That's really where civilization is at this point. I mean, it's not with you and me. It's inside the oligarchs that are having some kind of restraint in terms of the use of their electronic dollars to basically not let the public know that there are, you know, thousands of trillions of dollars that are basically in that they control, that they want the public to just accept the dollar as real until it evaporates, so that they can use it to take whatever that they want. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why I think that you could have, some kind of real, you know, dramatic terrorist event occur in the United States, because that would be the excuse for the reset.
Blame it on
the war. That would be, you know, if there is like a suitcase nuke explosion in the city, Tim, I don't care where you are, in the U.S., I would say it'd be very smart to bivouac some supplies and have some kind of physical security, because what you're going to see the next day will be a brand new America. It won't even look like what we are used to in America in any way, shape, or form. It will be completely transformed. And so you're going to need to be able to defend yourself if that occurs.
Oh, yeah, because the supply chains that we all depend upon for our consumer goods.
Yeah. Go to zero, and also, and also the dollar won't work.
Yeah, you had to exchange something. Yeah, with
how are you going to have currency? And you're going to be in a situation where you've got 60 million people on SNAP cards in the United States, and then another 40 million that are basically somewhere or another getting government subsidies for food. I mean, that's a lot of hungry people. Right, and I bet you a lot of them have weapons, and so now you've got a kind of gladiatorial pit inside the United States, and it won't just be here; it'll be everywhere. It'll be in Europe and Japan. It'll be all over the place, and you have a lot of hungry people, and very little way for the people who are suppliers to understand how they're going to get paid with anything.
Yeah,
you know, because the dollar is going to be like Willy Coyote on a cliff. It's just going to, you know, be running along, and all of a sudden it's going to look down and go, wait a second, there's nothing under me, and whoops. So this is bad news, and I'm just, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but if that happens, have some capacity, have some plan to defend yourself.
And you want to have people react, or just go into an area where a storm has come through, knocked out power for a couple of days, and already people they start to riot and fight each other.
Well, it's like New Orleans with Katrina. I mean, it doesn't take long. I think you'll actually, and also because I think the government will be provoking it.
Yeah,
you know, it's like you had pointed out that when they want a riot, they'll bring out an unpleasant judicial decision like Rodney King, you know, at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon, just in time to pick up, you know, on a balmy hot day. I mean, it's just, they don't want to bring it out on like Sunday afternoon or something, you know, when you wouldn't have the pop. They want the people in the street to get their SLA, Symbionese Liberation Army event. So that then they can put it on TV, and then, you know, everyone will go, well, we need more police.
Yeah, it justifies because, all the military. Then you'll see the tanks.
Yeah, the militarization of the police part, which occurred after the Rodney King thing, which was, in my opinion, just an absolute theatrical production. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so that's why we need, you know, people need to have some kind of a plan to basically protect themselves, you know. You know, so that's where we're at. It's you know, when once you start understanding that what, you know, pretends to be government, you know, defending you, is actually in the control of an organization that wants you off the planet, then you look at the NSA in a little different way. And you know, one thing that always amazes me, Tim, is that when America goes to war for these crazy things, that the public rallies to the president.
Yep.
And you go, oh my God, you know, we didn't like Donald Trump when he was, you know, selling condos that, you know, would fall apart in a month and grabbing pussies. But now that he's in hand-to-hand combat with Kim Jong, we've got to support our president.
Well, I want to see him get in a ring and shave Kim's head, like he did.
Yeah, now that would be, you know, and Donald weighs like 270 pounds. I mean, it would just be a great battle. I'd love to see them both in leotards or some kind of culturally sensitive, gender specific.
Well, it is funny because it is almost as ludicrous as like a World Wrestling Federation match.
World Wrestling, right? looks like a, you know, the Magna Carta compared to what's going on now. I mean, this is just the whole situation with Korea.
How is it like, you know, they unroll this thing every 5 months? And do you remember?
Yeah.
I mean, so it's like, really, you're doing this again? And really? I mean, does North Korea? I mean, do you really wake up in the morning fearing? You know, remember, I think the latest, the remake of Red Dawn involved North Koreans invading the United States. I mean, as ludicrous as the idea of the Soviet Union doing it was back in the 80s, now they have North Korea. I think the idea of original movie had Chinese doing it, and they changed it.
Well, it's like I was telling you before we started the show. People in middle America have nothing to worry about, because I'm telling you, here in Santa Barbara, we have the transgender militia, and we will stop the North Koreans right at our local organic restaurant. I mean, there is no way that those guys are going to breach 1 foot of America. I mean, you think they can get past our militia? Absolutely not.
Well, you know, we laugh at the idea of North Korea, and it is laughable. But think about, go back to 1941, where Americans were convinced that Japan posed a threat to the United States because it bombed an imperial military outpost that had been stolen 50 years before. I mean, and the idea that Japan was going to invade California.
You know, I know. You know, it was just ludicrous.
I mean, the fact that that war was being fought for American boys were fighting in Iwo Jima, on Guadalcanal, in New Guinea for America. Look at a map.
It's just ridiculous.
How did farm boys end up?
How do they do this? It just amazes me that they can create this.
And they went off in the millions to fight for their country. The greatest generation, right?
They were lined up around the block, you know. Yeah. They just couldn't wait to, like, you know, get in their rowboat and go over and bomb Japan.
You're a farm boy in Iowa or Idaho, and you have your family farm, and you're supposed to worry about a military outpost in Hawaii as if this is affecting you. They think that outpost was built for you and your family? It's ridiculous.
Well, my question is, what in hell are we doing in Hawaii?
No one asked that question.
There were Hawaiians there. They didn't want us there. You know, you've got to believe me. The Hawaiians did not invite us in. It's just, the whole thing is just oligarchic imperialism tipped to stern.
Yeah.
And you've got nothing but cannon fodder, you know, coming out of the farms in middle America, because the mind control was so effective that they just never had, as a group, the thought that we could be being manipulated.
How is it you end up in a situation where no one knows you, someone who doesn't even know you is trying to kill you? Well, blame your leaders. Blame the oligarchs. That's how it happens. Why is it?
Yeah, and there they are, you know, like landing on Iwo Jima.
Staging the flag scene, by the way.
Like the fake flag scene, you know, and it's just, you know, and
it makes for a great paperweight, though. I mean, it really is a great paperweight.
It is. But, you know, it's like, it's also just because it is completely fake, it's a great thing to have because it reminds you about the effects of mind control.
Yeah, and that fake fake scene is memorialized at Iwo Jima Memorial that oversees all these dead people, many of whom died in combat. A lot of them died later on, but they were traumatized by war. They were these veterans. It sets a psychological hold on people. I know people who were veterans of war, especially World War II, and it had such a searing influence on them, and they can't emotionally accept the fact that they were taken advantage of.
Yeah, I know, and I've said many times, the saddest thing in America is when they bring out the parents of some individual who's been killed, and they, you know, everyone weeps and you know, about, well, they are there in the Middle East, in Afghanistan, or in Yemen, defending America.
Or like I saw a scene where, if you go on the internet and if you go on your homepage of your internet provider, they have these horrible news stories. You know, it's always LGBTQ stuff or weird. You know, it's all, you know, fluff news or mind control, you know, stuff. But one thing is a military mother welcomed back by kids, and they have these three kids. They're grabbing their mother who just spent a year in Afghanistan. Now, what type of system does that?
Well, and what type of system can use that as an example of how righteous we are as a country? I mean, it's it's sort of like Bruce Jenner giving the award for heroism, you know, because of the courage to have a sex change operation.
Yes.
You know, you look at this and you go, well, heroism? You know, I mean, I don't know. Where are the boundaries of coherency and of righteousness that we actually have as a core, as a nation?
Well,
because at this point, nothing seems to be basically defensible.
Yeah.
And sort of like the unlimited sexualities, you know, that are now being permitted. They are basically trying to shatter the sense of self, right? And this leads not to freedom, obviously, but to just, you know, absolute control. These will be the chipped individuals who will show up to, you know, go off to Yemen, you know, to battle terrorism, right? You know, because they just don't know any better. They just don't have the capacity to think.
In the name of identity, they're destroying the basis for identity, which is one's sex.
Yeah.
Because
Yeah, and so anyway, so this is, you know, this is where the alt media comes in, and you know, people. Hopefully, some people will be listening to this. I'm really delighted, you know, when I read the comments that people post about our talks, and there are some good criticisms, but there's also a lot of people who you know, obviously connect to what we say and who seem to have energy with which to go to other kinds of behavior that, you know, that basically that we're just part of the process. You know, we try our best to give information. And then this stimulates activity, which then hopefully becomes further and further out into culture. And so we have a chance. I don't know how great a chance it is, Tim, but as we sit here talking, we are still free to some extent. We still have the power of reason.
Mm-hmm.
Many people will understand our perspective. And you know what, folks? Let's organize. Let's try to resist. Let's not, you know, walk into automatic weapon fire. Let's not rally to the president because he wants to go hand-to-hand with, I'm not going to use my little comic thing, with the Korean president again. let's try to create a process where reason influences democracy to benefit us and our families and our loved ones, right? Because what's going on out there in Korea or in Yemen, you know, or in Botswana has nothing to do with the immediate problems that we have, which one of which is that military spending is part of the thing which is destroying our capacity to have wealth, which is to say the dollar.
Yes.
So we've got these kinds of problems that we need to work on, and so we need organization, and let's go out there and create it.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. Exactly. And like I said, you know, going in the automatic weapon fire, or is like the guy orders you to go over the top and charge and go walk in the automatic weapon fire. If you don't follow the order, you'll be shot.
Right. That's a country you want to defend. And that's why there's only one rational response, and that's to attack the enemy. And the enemy is not the individual across the no man's land. Right, it's the guy in back of you with the gun.
Yeah, it's the.
I know it's sedition, can be, but there are. It's a complex legal situation. Perhaps a lawyer should be consulted there before you go over the top. You'd say, you know, I would like to obey the order,
but
we need to have a constitutional process to know if, in fact, it is within your rights to send me. When there has been no war declared by the process with the Constitution describes, mm-hmm. Over the top, where does your authority come from exactly here in this document, which is the basis for our social contract, which is why I'm even prepared to consider you as someone to give me orders in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if there isn't some process that makes sense to you, don't go over the damn top.
And what if everyone didn't?
Fire.
Like, what if everyone, they called the war and no one showed up, you know?
Well, what if they called the war and everyone wanted to talk to their attorney?
Yeah. He said, no, I'm not going to do it. And
I want,
you know,
a constitutional attorney to help to actually explain to me where your authority is coming from.
Yeah.
You know, Tim, I have a copy of the Constitution. I can't help it. I read it every day almost. And, Matt, I just don't see where it says that you have to go over the top and get wiped out. You know, I see a document that actually talks a lot about, you know, the rights to happiness.
Provide for the common defense.
Yeah.
Nor is any claim for the right to draft people, but yet that's for the common defense.
Yeah. So anyway, it just, you know.
Well, if one, you know, what would be the effect of sort of a general mutiny? And of course, it almost occurred. It did occur in the first year of the First World War.
Yeah, the Christmas armistice,
Christmas truce. And what if that had spread? I mean, people were like, "Well, we can't have that." Well, what if it had happened? Just think what all the slaughter, all the destruction, all the suffering.
There is absolutely no doubt that that is one of the great moments in the history of world citizenry. Was when. You know, in World War One, where the Allied and Axis troops decided that they would declare an armistice.
And the Germans traded chocolate for tobacco.
And they would stop fighting. Yeah. And you're right. The mind boggles. If there had been leaders who were willing to risk their lives to make sure that the troops, the armistice that we created was enforced and were willing to basically kill the enemy that would try to prevent it from happening, mm-hmm. right? Which is to say the Freemason officers like Winston Churchill, who would be standing there with his gun telling you to walk into the automatic weapon fire. If the troops had turned around and slaughtered that son of a bitch, then think of how much better the world would have been,
mm-hmm.
right? So this is something that the citizens needs to pay attention to.
Yeah, but Joe, if you had shot Churchill in 1914, 1915, or 1917, he would have been around to stop Hitler in 1940.
Well, you know, all I can say is when the Koreans land on the beach later on today, and I try to rally the Santa Barbarians for the counterattack, I'm going to say, you know, we will fight them in the organic food stands, on the nude beaches and in the transgender restrooms. We will never stop. We will grow more confident. I mean,
it won't be you. It'll be an actor like they do with Churchill, right?
Right. Someone who can actually do Churchill instead of me. But you get my point.
Yeah.
Is that, and also, if I'm going to do Churchill, I need to be drunk.
Yeah, that's right. It helps.
But which I don't drink alcohol, so it's going to be tough. But the thing is, this is, time for a new concept of citizenry, which is one that looks at, this stuff as mind control, as unconstitutional, and is willing to stand up for himself or herself.
Mm-hmm. Right. And critical thought, I guess you could say, is sedition. Let it be sedition. Then. I don't know.
Well, the thing is that, but you see, and then you have, contradictory principles in law. You know, the oligarchs will say, well, we have the process to establish the army, and you've got to obey us. You're in the army. But you see, but here's the Constitution, and so now we need a process to say which of the legal principles is more powerful. And frankly, I just want to take it to a jury of my peers, Tim. Mm-hmm. And then we'll just see how the oligarchs do when they say you've got to walk into automatic weapon fire. I just have a feeling they won't get very far with a jury of peers. So, there's hope. There's different ways. There's different things. But the main thing is let's communicate. Let's get the ideas out. And let's be courageous. Nothing to lose, man. They are definitely hell-bent to destroy us, to evaporate us. And so it's our responsibility as sentient beings to defend ourselves. Mm-hmm. So let's do it.
Okay. I think it's a good note to end it on.
Hey, always, I got to get down to the beach. I have to get to the the transgender counterattack. Guys, because we've got our North Korea bino watch that we're gonna to make sure that these, if I'm telling you, if these bastards get on our nude beach, all hell's gonna break loose. So
okay, Joe.
All right, brother.
Enjoy the weekend.
We'll talk next week.
Certainly. Take care.
If we're still around,
that's right.
I'll let you know. I'll give you progress.
We might be talking Korean. Talking Korean by then.
I might be talking in Korean, yeah.
Okay. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.